everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Work in Progress. This is Ko.
This is Sam.
And today we're very, very excited to have with us Ajita Jacob. She is the founder of an organization known as Proactive for Her. She's also an alumni of Harvard Business School. Today we're going to hear from Ajita on her journey. We're going to get into the femtech space, get into what Proactive for Her does, their mission, talk about, you know, culture in India and all such more things. So let's just dive right into it. Do you want to talk a little bit more about what our understanding of Proactive for Her is?
Yeah, thanks, Ko. So we're so excited to have you on. And like when we were going through your website and seeing what your company does, the term judgment-free really stood out to me personally. In my personal experience, whenever I have gone to a gynec, I was diagnosed with PCOS when I was 13 or 14 years old. And there were a lot of things that they told me that have stayed with me till today. For example, one of my gynecs had told me that PCOS is a fat girl's problem, and that really stood out to me. And I'm sure many of the girls listening to our podcast today will really relate to the term judgment free, because that's what they hope their experiences with their doctors, clinicians, gynecs should be like. But we wanted to hear from you about what Proactive for Her is about and why you started this amazing organization.
Great. Thanks, Simran. We're doing our very best to tackle judgment-free healthcare in India. But just in terms of the genesis of where this idea came about, so I'm going to go way back to 2017-2018. I was in fact working in healthcare. I was working at a chain of dialysis clinics in India. And one of the things that I observed was that we would see older women, you know, women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, who were on dialysis, really hold back when it came to their own treatment. And anecdotally, we would hear about, you know, women saying, I don't want to have 3 sessions of dialysis this week, or, you know, take more dosages of erythropoietin, or, you know, holding back on treatment because they felt like that money was better spent elsewhere. And that was my first aha moment about how healthcare is not just about, you know, your access to doctors, whether you have a clinic 6 kilometers away. It's more about your willingness to access the healthcare that you have, whether it's at home, online, in person. And there's a lot of cultural dominance of how we interpret what we deserve, right? So a lot of these women were saying, hey, I don't deserve the best healthcare, or I'm not sure if I'm worth spending money on. And I think that's a big part of the cultural gap that we need to fill. And, you know, anecdotally, growing up in metros, in my 20s, being surrounded by women who were sexually active, and being sexually active myself, it was so clear that there is no healthcare that's tailored to deal with sexual health and sexual wellness in India. And that was sort of the starting point for us at Proactive for Her as well. Whether you talk about, you know, getting an abortion, or, you know, even something as simple as having a UTI, there's always this underlying sense. I remember I had a UTI, and there was an underlying sense of, oh, you know, what have you been up to? Why do you have a UTI? Because one of the reasons you may get a UTI is been sexually active, especially with a new partner. Mm-hmm. So there's so much of judgment, and there's so much of taboo, and unfortunately, I think it's also on both sides. We definitely have to change how we think about healthcare in a non-cultural context, where we, you know, don't judge women or men or anybody really for having premarital sex, but also in terms of us as women not holding back and asking for the healthcare we deserve. I think that's how we think about it at Proactive.
No, for sure. Like, it's so interesting what you're saying about the cultural aspect. I think we all have experienced our own mothers, maybe, that they might be unwell, but they're so unwilling to maybe go to the doctor because they are worried about 1,000 other things at home. Then I think shifting little towards the being sexually active in India and what that looks like from a healthcare point of view. So there is like there's a lot of conversation on your company's website about birth control, and something y'all do so amazing is that y'all have a birth control assessment program. And I personally, the first thing then when I had gone to my gynec, they had clearly told me, you have PCOS, you go on birth control. There was no conversation, okay, of what I'm looking for, how it might impact me, what would the symptoms be, and what would the right birth control for me be. And I know, yeah, having conversations with my friends, that they have also experienced that a lot, that they have been on a certain birth control that's not worked and getting that changed constantly. But I would love to hear from you about that aspect of creating that program as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when it comes to birth control, it really is patient-driven, because a lot of what's the right birth control for you depends on what are your goals. You know, do you want to get pregnant in the next 6 months or not? Or, you know, what are your lifestyle choices? Do you have multiple sexual partners, right? So while, you know, the pill may help you with prevention of pregnancy, it does not help you with protection against STIs. So what's the right birth control for you is extremely driven and influenced by what are your goals, aspirations, needs and wants as a consumer of that birth control. And I think extremely similarly, what is the right next steps and clinical pathway for you as someone who has PCOS is completely dependent, again, on what your goals are, what your symptoms are, how would you like to manage them, and what are your expectations out of this. It has to be completely customized, personalized. And what you really want more than anything else is for the clinician and your team of doctors, whether that's your gynecologist, your endocrinologist, your nutritionist, your coach, your fitness instructor. You want someone to hear you and sort of put you at the center of the program that you're designing. And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. So I think... Yeah. Being extremely patient-centric is a key for us to achieve better clinical outcomes. Because if we are dismissive and we, you know, sort of give someone a diet chart that they're not really happy and there's no compliance with that treatment plan, then you don't really see outcomes. So there's no
one-size-fits-all approach that should be there in healthcare. Like you said, it should be more personalized.
Yeah, stays true to Proactive for being a femtech brand, right? Because you're using then technology to personalize, to customize. So can you tell us a little bit more about that as well? Because I think this, you know, when Simran told me she found this program or let's say questionnaire, I found it super interesting because there's not that much of customization that happens in this space at all. There's a lot of content, yes, but there isn't that much of, okay, let me find it exactly for you. So I feel that's a great advantage that, you know, you've cultivated. So could you tell us a little bit more about that as well?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the birth control assessment, and we have, you know, on our website, even some risk quizzes around cervical cancer. And so this is interesting, but this is really not a substitute for clinical advice. So while you might answer a few questions and understand how different aspects of your lifestyle influence different risk factors clinically across a spectrum of issues, true personalization and customization really happens in the clinician's room, right? While you are speaking to your doctor, which is why it's so important that there is a judgment-free zone where you can share openly what your history is, what your symptoms are, and also what your goals and aspirations are. If you do want to lose weight, being able to say that openly, or if you don't want to talk about your weight, being able to say that openly as well is really important. So I think while tech is important from an information sharing and empowering the customer to know how different aspects of their lifestyle might impact different choices, and giving them that information so they can see what the toolkit looks like, I think the true customization actually happens in the clinician's office. And one of the most interesting things we've been doing for birth control recently is this. I didn't even know that there is a form of birth control where you, instead of having an IUD inserted, you can instead have something inserted into your arm which is equally effective and dispenses the right amount of hormonal contraceptive. So all of this is something that we've been on our own learning journey as a company to figure out what's best in class for women's health and how can we push the boundaries of what's available to women in India.
Honestly, like you said about the insertable birth control, reading your website only, I realized that I didn't know there were two types of IUDs also, that there's a copper one and there's a hormonal one, etc. But just touching base a little bit on what you also talking about, yes, it's not a substitute for a clinician's advice, etc. But obviously, I think it's a great substitute for when we are looking at our symptoms, we just maybe Google search it. And we get hit with thousand information sources, etc. But if there are quizzes like this from a technology perspective, maybe we can get a better, clearer understanding from somewhat of experts. So that's what was fascinating to us as well. And you mentioned a point on education and how that is extremely important, especially in the sexual wellness space and reproductive health space.
And there's personally so much that we actually discovered coming onto the page. You know, there were so many things that we didn't know about. And I think that also makes us think that there's so many more things that we don't know. So I find that like there's obviously a big need of educating sort of more. And how has that experience, you know, been for you to handhold new customers or women coming and sharing their stories or, you know, maybe explaining that I'm facing this, but not having the right tools or terms to explain it as well. Like, how do you empower them?
I think that's definitely the role that we are playing as a company, through our doctors, through what we communicate to our customers. And in fact, I would say one of the most useful words that we've been the pioneers in the country to get out is the term vaginismus. A lot of women have painful sex, and of course there are many reasons behind it, and one of which could be vaginismus, where you require a lot of experts to come together to help you heal from whether it's primary vaginismus or secondary vaginismus, heal from your experiences that are causing difficulty with penetration and painful sex. I still remember the first time I heard the word vaginismus. I was in business school, I was 28 years old. And we were all sitting in a classroom and sharing stories. A lot of women were, you know, opening about very personal anecdotes. And one of my classmates, in fact, said that she had vaginismus and it had taken her years to get diagnosed. And I was like, oh, I don't even know what this is. And then I went home and I Googled it and I understood a little bit more. At this point of time, I was already working on a women's health startup while sitting in business school. And what was very revealing to me is that women have to be part of this narrative and this change, saying that there is more to women's health than having a baby and getting pregnant. And it's women like me and you that have to sort of, you know, play this role, because it's not going to necessarily happen organically in the country. It's going to happen when women start asking for more and start, you know, saying that they deserve better healthcare across the country.
Yeah. In fact, vaginismus was something I didn't know about either. And I actually looked into some of the stories that women shared. And, you know, it's sad, but you can imagine this happening where a lot of women felt there was something wrong with themselves, that, you know, you put pressure on yourself, like, why am I not able to? Is there something wrong with me? But then when you are educated again, like you have the tools to understand and then sort of just feel empowered, feel okay. And I think a big part of that is also sharing and being comfortable with talking about these things. You know, we collectively have so much stigma to even admit or to look a certain way or to not come across as, like, you know, I don't know, be labeled in a certain way. So I think it's really, really important. Like, I was blown away when I read that, and I felt so happy that, you know, there is now a platform or there's some amount of awareness, even if it's little, but it's a large, large sort of journey that we need to take to make people more comfortable discussing, opening up, and, you know, then understanding how empowered they feel.
Even one of the doctors, I think we were reading when we were listening to sessions on vaginismus that y'all have been doing, one of the doctors was mentioning that they didn't know they had it for 7 years, and then they found out and cured it with the help of a program, etc. So, but also one thing I think we had discussed in our pre-conversation was this is all, we are the top 10% maybe of the country that is, and we still don't know these terms and we're still not maybe as informed as we should be. But just wanted to talk about that as well, that what do you think about that? Where do you think it's going? How we can help make more women feel more comfortable talking about these things?
Yeah, I think we're starting some of that right here today with this conversation, right? I think it takes a certain amount of courage to say, yes, I have been sexually active. And yes, I have had a UTI. And yes, I have had a vaginal infection. There's way too much cultural taboo associated with what is actually a very simple healthcare problem statement with a very clear clinical pathway to solve for some of these concerns. And while it might be a little bit more easier to say that I have PCOS today, it's a little bit harder to still say that I think I might have an STI and I need to go get tested. So I think a lot of allowing for open conversations is for women who are empowered to speak about it in their circles, on public forums, and to normalize the conversation around both sex as well as sexual wellness, because you can't normalize the sexual wellness conversation without normalizing the conversation around sex. And, you know, the thing with sex is everyone's having it and no one is talking about it. I think we had initially spoke about the fact that, you know, maybe a decade back, the point at which you got sexually active and the point at which you got into potentially a heteronormative marriage, right, which was probably the trend back then, that window was really small. So, you know, you didn't have a very large window between getting sexually active and getting partnered up monogamously for the long term. And today, I think that window is much larger. You know, you'd have people getting active sexually in their teens, in their early 20s, and not necessarily getting married till their 30s, mid-30s, late-30s even, right? So that increased gap means we need to have a different approach to sexual health. We need women and men and everyone else as well getting tested for STIs. You know, if you have multiple partners, getting tested regularly, maybe even every 6 months. Every time you get into a new physical intimate relationship, getting tested at that point of time with both maybe you and your partner, having pap smears more regularly, getting your HPV vaccination. Unfortunately, yeah. It's only just come into our national immunization program. And prior to that, most of us who are now in our 20s and 30s have probably not gotten jabbed, and we should. So a lot of this includes normalizing. We've heard ridiculous statements from folks we've been in conversation with, where you see moms say that I won't give my daughter the HPV vaccine because I don't want to put promiscuity. So just getting the sex, you know, HPV vaccination doesn't mean that she's going to become sexually active or not, right? That's going to happen irrespective. You don't really control that when your kids go off to college or to high school or whatever. Having that change in mindset around what it means to be sexually empowered, I think is key here.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned something interesting, you know, right now where you said that we've just had the sort of government scheme or government awareness that's, you know, pushing for it. What role do you think that any sort of healthcare scheme has been playing in India in the last couple of years? In general healthcare, yes, there's been, you know, a lot of, let's say, investment or lots of branded programs. But when it comes to women's health specifically, and maybe
even sexual wellness for a fact, like, do you think there is space for the government initiatives that are out there? That, because our government is focusing on women's health, but it looks more towards maternal health overall and maybe not the other aspects of it. So just your thoughts on that.
I think we're a little far away from bringing, you know, world-class sexual wellness from larger institutions, including the government. I think there's obviously only so much that can be done. And obviously, there's a huge shortage of even the clinical staff outside of metros. It's much easier to find doctors in metros and tier one cities as well. So I think that gap is something that will take a while to bridge. But what we can do and what we can achieve in the very near future, maybe the next couple of years itself, is really bridging that gap in metros and tier one cities where women have the ability to pay for better healthcare. You know, you're paying 1500 rupees for a haircut and 1000 rupees for a pedicure and 500 rupees to get your underarms waxed, right? Like, there is a lot of spending power, especially amongst women who are financially independent, educated, working in metros. They have the ability to just go and pay for the services they need. I think that's something we're going to solve sooner rather than later. Whereas I think the government might have to play that bridge between allowing for healthcare access for those who can't afford it and play a more active role in that space.
For sure. Also, just you had touched upon this a while ago about abortions and abortion conversations. Since you have been in the US and you have studied there, it's really terrifying, honestly, to see what's happening there with regards to abortions, etc. Just wanted to know, because since you know so much on ground, what's happening, you're in touch with gynecologists, etc. Is there a similar maybe apprehension towards that here as well? Or do you think we are much more evolved in that conversation?
Not at all. I feel like, unfortunately, the US is going two steps back when it comes to respecting women's autonomy over their own bodies. But I don't think that's the case in India. I think the law is super clear and it's very empowering. Right? The US, the struggle is there might be an educated society, but unfortunately, a certain part of them and the laws don't support for the right that women deserve in terms of having autonomy over their own bodies. Fortunately for us, we have everything that we need from a legal perspective to get the right care. The bottleneck really is because premarital sex is such a taboo and because a lot of people feel shame. See, no one can shame you unless you sort of let them. And unfortunately, you might get into systems or institutions where you need an abortion, but there is a lot of whispering and a lot of judgment. And I think oftentimes, because everybody sort of wants to have a lot of hush-hush around it, we have seen that everything is not transparent, including pricing and treatment and choice and consent, which is so important in this process, right? A lot of that is not transparent, not above the water. And at Proactive for Her, obviously, we try to make things as easy and judgment-free and simple as possible. But I think that's not necessarily the case across the country. And we've heard a few horror stories of women who needed an abortion. And when you feel like you're entering a setup where there is a lot of judgment around why are you pregnant if you're not married, you don't go back and fight. You know, you don't say, no, I'm not going to pay this extra 1,000 rupees, or no, I'm not going to be spoken to this way, or how dare you question, anything.
Me and my choices.
Lose that fighting spirit. And that's what we've heard from stories of other women who've told us about their horror stories, is you're not as empowered in that situation because everybody else is kind of putting you down. And I think, if you choose to not proceed with your pregnancy because you're young or you're unmarried or you just don't want to move ahead with it, we wish we lived in a world where that would be a simple medical procedure with no questions asked and no judgment.
Yeah.
No, for sure. Like, I feel the conversations around abortion and the questions that might come up, that is anyway scary and daunting. But even just a regular gynec appointment, if you do go, I'm sure many people listening might have experienced the same. One of the questions they do ask is, are you married? And that is one of the first questions they do ask. And I've had a personal experience where I've gone for a sonography appointment because I need to check my cysts for my PCOS. And this must be 8, 9, 10 years ago. And the technician who was doing the sonography asked me, how many weeks are you? And I was at that point, an 18-year-old child. So without even doing the procedure, them assuming that, oh, I'm coming for a sonography appointment because I'm pregnant, or them asking that, oh, are you married? These questions also, they put seeds in your mind that might hinder you from doing that again. And
but I just want to add, like, I also have had an alternate experience in a good way where, for example, like, the Rega Jha is a famous, you know, writer, and I follow her on Instagram. And she started posting a lot about women's health, and she had just put a story, went to my gynec today. She asked me if I was sexually active. I said yes, and we high-fived each other, you know, and it was just a simple act, but it made it seem so, yes, like, it's okay. Earlier, at least, like, maybe earlier when we were probably 18, was a very, like, you go with your mother.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, you know, you don't want to answer these questions. I think now, at least in metros, a little bit of a change in conversation has been there. And it's a small thing that I saw where I felt happy and I was like, okay, great. Like, this is not daunting. I can be myself. I can share. This is why I'm going. So yeah, it's good to, like, keep an eye on sort of both sides of it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we are trying to solve for is this shouldn't be Russian roulette. You shouldn't have to guess how you're going to be treated once you enter a clinic. You should know for a fact that these are the values, this is what I should expect, this is what this organization and this entire team stands for. And then if you feel like your values haven't been adhered to or your expectations haven't been met, then you feel like you have the right to complain and you have the right to say, hey, that's not okay, which I feel all customers of healthcare or any other product should have that ability to say, hey, I'd like you guys to do better. We're very focused on customer feedback. We try to get feedback from everybody who comes into the clinic. That's definitely our bread and butter for doing better by each of our customers. And absolutely, I think we are evolving as a society. And a lot of folks who are speaking about things that openly, including the writer you mentioned, I think that's creating a lot of the change we want to see in society today.
Yeah. And I think maybe we just want to now shift gears a bit and, you know, understand from you, how has your experience been running a startup, especially considering you started properly in 2020, and everywhere we read, we see that the femtech space is booming. There are companies that, but we just want to know, you know, what has your experience been with this?
Yeah. One thing they don't tell you about starting a women's health company is it might not be good for your own health, physical or mental. It's been a very humbling process, and also the best learning experience of my life. And I would hands down not have spent the last 2 or 3 years doing anything else but doing what I did. It's also very rewarding because almost every day I get at least one email from a customer who is so glad that we exist. It's like a little bit of an adrenaline kick, right? It's like Instagram 2.0, where it's not like people liking your photos, but people being like, you know, email, hey, I love your company. And I think it's very addictive as well. I think that's what keeps you going as a founder, because there are so many roadblocks along the way and it can feel exhausting at different points of time. But what's rewarding is to know that you're doing something meaningful on a day-to-day basis. And fortunately for us, because we are D2C, we have physical clinics, we can literally see our customers walk in and walk out happy. That's a very rewarding process. So it hasn't been easy. But I wouldn't have had it any other way.
Yeah, I actually had seen one of your LinkedIn posts probably like a year back or 2 years back. And it was like 30 things or maybe 50 things that like someone who's starting a company should keep in mind. And I think obviously what stays is the customer centricity. Like I think that is very obvious for anyone who even comes to the page or sees the website, you know, so definitely more power to you. But like, what are your thoughts on the other companies as well bubbling up in this space? Is it helping accelerate growth, or has it been like a, you know, sort of slower journey or sharing of the pie? Like, what has that been?
Yeah, the pie is going to explode, right? That's our point of view. The pie doesn't exist today. The pie is baking.
Yeah.
And the yeast is fermenting and the dough is rising. All of that is happening. We would love to see more players out there. I think there aren't enough healthcare players, and there's so much to women's health outside of what we do. We have a very clear focus on sexual health, reproductive health, menstrual health. But there's a lot more around it. And we see a few players looking at spaces where we are not currently active. For example, menopause amongst others. And even within, you know, IVF and birthing and pregnancy, there's so much more to be done, maybe with a different kind of structure, not necessarily early stage VC-funded companies. So we think that this is, we're just scratching the surface. And we know from what our customers tell us that we are very much at the right time. Sometimes you worry that, oh, are we too early? Are women ready for this, right? Is there enough women out there for us to exist? And one of our big fears setting up our second clinic was like, oh, we're attracting all the women in Bangalore into our first clinic. And the minute we set up our second clinic, suddenly we're going to see that there are only so many women, and some of the women are going into the second clinic. And, you know, the month we launched our second clinic did really well, and the revenue of our first clinic increased as well. Which, you know, actually, this is probably bigger than we think it is. And now we're building clinic 3, and clinic 4, 5, 6 should also hopefully be up by the end of the year, in Bangalore, of course. So it's exciting. It's exciting to ride this wave. There's a lot to be figured out, especially from a product point of view, right? What is women's health outside of pregnancy and getting pregnant? And it's a question that we're asking ourselves, investors are asking themselves, but also every single woman is asking herself this question: what more should I be doing for my health?
Yeah.
And hope to be that voice of information with time that gives people very easy pathways to see, okay, this is what I can do. Yep, I can get my STI test, I can get my pap smear, you know, I can get my HPV vaccination. Like, we don't have to figure out everything. Nothing is a mystery. I'm really bummed that I only got my vaccination in my late 20s, because I only found out about it in my mid 20s, and eventually I got vaccinated at the clinic I built myself. So it was a bummer for me to say, you know, why not earlier, because I'd been sexually active earlier as well. So we want to do that for women and for ourselves. A lot of women working at Proactive for her as well. A lot of women leadership here. And we're hoping that we can figure some of these things out. And we're very excited about it.
That's really exciting. We hope you come to Bombay as well. We also would love to see a clinic like yours
and
over here.
Visit it for sure. I mean, it's so inspiring. I think we also, you know, we saw, I would like you to say it, I don't want to miss say it, but I think there were a lot of organizations and initiatives also that, you know, Proactive has taken up for women in general, apart from what you do internally, right? I think there was something that that was done with the government, or that was done locally, you know, for women. So could you talk to us about that as well? Because we just briefly saw like a post about it, but found it really interesting.
We do a whole bunch of community events. We work with, you know, companies like Leap and smaller communities as well, where we do things. So I'm not quite sure what you would have seen. But we tried to sort of...
We saw one of the like community events where it had a really interesting topic, you know, where it was basically talking about how can we empower more women and educate them to get into, to understand themselves better, rather. So just could you shed some light on like what kind of, you know, initiatives and sort of talks that you guys do?
We work with women communities. We also work with corporates. It's not a revenue strategy for us. We use that just to build awareness. We work with 40 companies till date. And it's just another avenue to get the word out there and to share more information. Usually one of our doctors would end up, you know, doing a webinar or a talk. And it helps people know and ask questions, not be afraid. Know more about stuff. So, I don't think we have done anything with the government so far. But maybe I can like circle back and check.
I think one of the things that we were talking about was, you know, the accessibility point of view for this, especially in our country. Do you want to share what?
Yeah, so basically recently, maybe like 2-3 weeks ago, the help in my house, she's just turned 18, I think. That's her age. So she came up to me in very secret, and she was just like, when my mom was out of the room, and she was just like concerned about her menstrual health, and she had so many questions to ask. And I just felt it was a moment of reckoning a little for me, because I didn't, in my mind, I didn't think that, okay, this is some sort of information she's not getting, that she thought that she had to come to me to get that. And from that point of view, me and Co were talking, and we were talking about how these are conversations that we are just having, but to have those conversations with other people as well who might not have access to that information online. So that was just a moment that
we've obviously, there's a long way to go in that regard. Like in our friend circles as well, people are apprehensive, but I think that's a larger challenge to tackle, right? Especially with healthcare in general and female health in specific, like how do we sort of make it more accessible, or maybe just have more conversations, you know, or drive behavior shifts, changes where like everybody is sort of aware.
Because like just an example, like we just came to know about vaginisms today, like during our conversation and doing research for this podcast, but what would be the equivalent term to explain to them how to go about it, etc. So that was just something that from a thought perspective, I was really introspecting about that I'm learning these things, but what about other people, you know?
No, that's a great point. I think unfortunately there's no silver bullet here, but what we are hoping is that if we can crack this for India's top 10%, then there will be a trickle-down effect into every other layer of socioeconomic strata. But we need to first crack this, because I think we're barely scratching the surface, even for women who have money, who have the time and want to invest in themselves. They may not always know what the right answers are or what the right options on the table are. So first, like laying out those options and saying, here's your, you know, range of things you can do to invest in your health. And I think we've seen that. We go to a salon, we know what to expect. We're like, this is the menu card, right? Building out the menu card for women's health in India, especially beyond pregnancy and beyond IVF, is something that we see ourselves doing.
Yeah, no, for sure. Also, one point that we were thinking about, like that now that you've brought up that whole access point and the menu card aspect of it, is just that like when you're thinking about, okay, if I'm thinking about my sexual health, like what are the three things maybe that I should do every year? Like if our listeners had to just take away something from this conversation, and since sexual health isn't spoken about widely, we might want to just touch base on that. I know you touched a little on it before, but if there were three things that are must do's for girls like us, what would those three things be?
Yeah, a little dependent on what sort of your age and lifestyle is, but let me assume that I'm answering this question for women who are sexually active in their 20s or 30s. What should you do about sexual health? So I would say number one, if you're sexually active, whether it's with, monogamous partner or otherwise, do get an STI test. It's just always better to be safe to know, to have information. Unfortunately, what most women don't know is that all STIs are either curable or treatable, right? You can treat it if you cannot cure it. And unfortunately, if you don't do either, it could result in quite serious issues, including infertility. So just get an STI test. Don't worry about it. You can find a non-judgmental place near you to get it. Proactive for Her offers STI testing pan-India. Number two, get your annual pap smear. This is something that happens in all developed countries. You know, you go in for your annual checkup, you get a pap smear. And cervical cancer is the second most common form of cancer after breast cancer. And we all know about breast cancer because we all remember those pink ribbons from our school days and from our workplaces. But unfortunately, nobody's talking about cervical cancer or ovarian cancer. So just get your pap smear, protect yourself against cervical cancer. And I would say probably number three would be, don't ignore symptoms, whether that's a vaginal discharge or it could be, you know, pain while you have sex or anything else. Right? I think we tend to, as women, try to make ourselves less inconvenient to everything that's happening around us. So there's a little bit of self-silencing that sometimes happens. So be vocal about your symptoms. And I think a lot of the stories that we hear from our customers is they were experiencing something, or whether it's something as simple as discharge or, you know, painful sex or anything else in between. They were experiencing this for a long period of time before they thought that things can be better. And there are solutions out there for anything that you're experiencing. So I would say don't ignore symptoms.
Love the three points that you covered. I feel like I personally have few doubts about certain pointers. I'm sure maybe people do as well. For the HPV vaccine, I was reading that maybe there is, I'm not sure, I might be wrong, that there's an age limit. You can get it before 27. If you do after 27, it might not be as useful to you. Is that true?
So Gardasil 4 and Gardasil 9, you can take up to the age of 45. Now, if you look at the CDC guidelines by the US, one of the reasons they say, you know, 26 is because a lot of women in the US probably are sexually active a little before women in India. So, you know, and this is also usually covered by insurance or some form of institutional coverage. If you look at the age up to which the efficacy has been tested is up to the age of 45. And we have so many women in their 30s and early 40s coming to our clinic and taking the vaccine. Another myth, if I may add to your point.
Yes, for sure. I was going to ask you one more, but you go ahead.
It's also the fact that you can't take this vaccine after you are sexually active. So, for example, Gardasil 4 protects you against 4 strains of HPV, and Gardasil 9 is 9 strains, right? Basically, you know, even if you have exposure to a few strains, you should still take the vaccine. It protects you against everything else. So again, another myth is that I shouldn't take the cervical cancer vaccine because I have already been sexually active, and I took the vaccine after I've been sexually active, and so many of our customers do as well. So I feel like that's the other myth out there.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask, I feel like many people, the first thing I heard was, yes, you should do your pap smear. But then my mother told me it's extremely painful. And when I did it, it was uncomfortable for sure, but it wasn't as painful. So even I feel like that's a myth, but I would like you also to expand on that.
I think there's an awareness problem. Like, I was having this discussion with someone where they shockingly didn't know, and I mean, they're older, didn't know that, like if you go to a gynec for an appointment, they will suggest that you do it just before any other test, right? But they got very uncomfortable with that suggestion and didn't want to do it, you know? And then we sort of had to be like, this is normal. So I think that there's a massive awareness issue as to why it's being done, and two, that it is perfectly normal to do it.
And it's not so painful that you won't be able to handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Absolutely. I think like this is a consistent feedback we get from our customers saying, you know, of course, we use the right equipment. There are different types of equipment sometimes. You know, there's the metal kind and there's the disposable kind. The disposable kind is a little kinder on your body. And that's what we use. So there's a little bit of variation there, but a lot of pain could also be if you're not feeling comfortable and if you feel like the process is rushed and you aren't being told, you know, I'm now doing this, I'm now doing that, so you can be mentally prepared as you go through the procedure. I think a lot of making that as less painful as possible is about the clinician patiently walking you through the process and then taking the time to sort of make you comfortable before going ahead. And that's sort of the positive feedback we've heard saying, you know, it's very glad, didn't hurt. And a lot of that is just you being comfortable, because if you're not comfortable, then you're likely to feel discomfort while the process is happening.
No, for sure. And I feel like these are important conversations to have. And the last thing that you brought up was STI testing. And I think during our pre-conversation also, we had touched upon it a bit, is just that I personally didn't know that, oh, you can do a STI test every year. Like, I was under the impression that, okay, if you see something and you feel like something is wrong after you have had a sexual experience, etc., then you will go for a STI test. But it's perfectly healthy and normal to do it every 6 months, every 1 year, if you are sexually active. I feel like that is also a thing people don't consider.
Yeah, definitely. And especially, I think definitely at a point that you are switching sexual partners and moving from one partner to the next, you know, what I've seen in the US is when people start a new relationship, both partners just go get tested before being sexually. And we've seen that also with a lot of couples who come to our clinic, because we're obviously happy to do an STI test for anyone. And they come together and they do a test together, say, okay, you know, we're going to get tested together. So may not be your ideal Valentine's Day outing, but definitely something.
No, it's important for sure. I think like the sort of one of the last few things we wanted to ask you were, you know, what are some, I guess, like people, books, things, talks that you look up to obviously know more, but also just be inspired and like keep going to one, run a company, to empower other people. Like it's a lot. So what do you sort of turn to?
I listen to a lot of podcasts about people building companies. How I Built This by Guy Raz is something that I listen to, I think, every day in the shower, in the morning.
Oh, wow.
And there's a whole bunch of good stuff out there. I think what I also find very inspiring is to touch base with fellow founders who are either at the same stage or a couple of stages ahead. Mm. And I have that vibrant community. I think, luckily, living in Bangalore allows for that. Mm. Just, I don't know, it's a bit of a joke, but you can throw a stone and it'll probably either hit an engineer or a founder. And it's true, actually. A lot of founders live very close by. So there's a thriving community that you get to be a part of. And it's inspiring to hear from them and how they are dealing and tackling with issues.
That's amazing. It's just so inspiring to hear these things and, like, you know, see people like you build these amazing companies and communities and really, like, educate people and, like, be proactive in that sense. But we wanted to, the last question we wanted to ask is, like, our podcast name is Work in Progress. So we wanted to just check, how are you in a work in progress?
Oh, that's a great question, actually. I think being a founder is an evolution. It's not a static role, right? Because in the first week or month or few months of your company, you're like, oh, what are we going to do? And it's very high level. And then you hit the ground, and at every point of time, I would say, at least for me personally, in the last 2 years, every 3 months, the skills I've had to had, and the tasks I've had to do have evolved and changed. So it's been the most humbling process and also the most exciting process. So I would say the founder that Proactive for Her needed between month zero and month 12 is a different founder from month 12 to month 24 and month 24 to month 36. So I need to keep changing to keep pace with the business. I think it forces you to be a work in progress when you run a company.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. Like, this has been so inspiring and super, super, super insightful.
Yeah, I'm sure like everyone listening would have learned something new today about how to be proactive for their health.
Yeah.
And we are excited to see where you go. And I hope you come to Bombay soon.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a long way to go. But like you said, conversations like these are at least pointing the needle in the right direction. So just very, very grateful to you for that.
Great. Awesome. Thanks, Komal. Thanks, Simran. It's been a fantastic conversation.